Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Tom Waller. I'm chair of the club's Business and Leadership Forum and your host for today's program, which is entitled The Changing Face of American Wealth. We want to welcome all of our audience here with us this evening. We invite you to visit us on the internet often at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine program events held here at the club. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Louis Schiff is a senior managing principal for Advanced Planning Group in New York City, where he leads a team of private wealth experts who develop custom financial solutions for high net worth clients globally. He is also a contributor to Investment Advisor magazine and TheStreet.com and maintains a blog about the affluent for InvestmentAdvisor.com and Inc.com. Prior to founding Advanced Planning Group in 2007, Schiff was a founder of CEG Worldwide, a performance coaching firm serving the high-end financial advisor, and he was based in New York City and operated as well here in Silicon Valley. He has also developed custom education programs for high-profile financial firms such as Charles Schwab, Fidelity, E-Trade, and many others. Schiff was the founding editor of Worth Online, the electronic version of Worth Magazine, which launched in 1996. In 2001, he co-wrote the book, Armchair Millionaire, Building an Extraordinary Portfolio on an Ordinary Income. And in 2006, he published the A to Z Money Book, his collected columns originally published on CNNMoney.com during the years 2002 to 2004. His newest book, co-written with leading affluence researcher Russ Allen Prince, is The Middle Class Millionaire, The New Rich and How They Are Changing America, which was published earlier this year. The Middle Class Millionaire has been internationally acclaimed in numerous publications, and even our own San Francisco Chronicle wrote that occasionally a book emerges that establishes a new reality. That strikes me as the case with The Middle Class Millionaire. Please join me in welcoming Louis Schiff.
Thanks very much, Tom. Well, it's good to be here. It's good to be in San Francisco. Thanks to the Commonwealth Club for having me. I remember my first visit to San Francisco very clearly. It was August 1987. And what I remember about that trip actually was started with me driving up the West Side Highway in New York City in my 1966 cherry red Ford Mustang, barreling up the West Side Highway where I'm in New York City, where I'm from. I vaguely remember having Going Mobile by The Who playing on the radio as I drove up the West Side Highway. I was headed to the George Washington Bridge. And for those of you who don't know the geography of that area, the George Washington Bridge connects the island of Manhattan with the continental United States. Actually, it connects you to New Jersey. But just on the other side of that bridge is Interstate 80. And Interstate 80 continues for 3,000 miles until it deposits you in downtown San Francisco. And that's the trip I took. I was 18 years old at the time. I came out here because I was really into cars when I was that age. And as soon as high school ended, you really can't be a car person in New York too well. But all the magazines I'd grown up with described California as the place where all the car culture was. So that's what I did. I headed out here, and I got a job at a little gas station as a mechanic. And the gas station was called Suba's Texaco. And it was in Palo Alto. For those of you who know that area, it was on Waverly. And at Suba's Texaco, I got to do everything I'd hoped to do. I got to work on all sorts of muscle cars and, you know, spend all day in the engine bays of these cars and until my back hurt and my fingers hurt. And I really loved every minute of it. It was a great, thrilling part of my life. I think I was making about $6 an hour. But more than anything, I was making my own way in the world, and I was really enjoying it. I did not think about my future much back then. If I had thought at all about my future, I could have walked from the garage I was working at to another garage just a few blocks away, the garage that Hewlett-Packard started out of. and I could have seen what it was like to be part of one of the original Silicon Valley startups. Could have gone a few more miles down the road to Cupertino, California, where back then a little company called Apple Computer was just getting started. Or Intuit, or Intel, or company after company whose, as we now know, products and services would change the world. And the people, the young people, not much older than I was at the time, who ran these companies, they had gone on to create wealth and fortunes the likes of which the world had never seen. I didn't know anything about money back then. If you'd asked me to name a rich person, I probably would have said Thurston Howell III or something like that. I had no familiarity with money, really, as a topic. But in fact, what was so remarkable about these young people, the names of which we all now know, they became successful and wealthy by virtue of the choices they made and the paths they took. So just to get us started here today, if I could just ask you to yell out some of the names of these faces of wealth that come to mind when we think of today's modern icons of wealth. Anybody? Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett, just one of the great investors of all time. Right? Bill Gates. Walt Disney. Well, he's not around anymore. Yeah. Anyone else? Anyone else? Sergey Brin. It's good that you know him here, because in most parts of the country, people just say the Google guys. There you go. I'm one step ahead of you. And my favorite face of wealth, Thurston Howell III. A guy who was so rich, even on an island where there was no money, he was still the richest person there. I never quite figured that one out. But with all these different kinds of people, we're talking about a group that is illustriously called the Forbes 400, that annual compendium of America's wealthiest families. And in the year 2007, a Rubicon was crossed. For the very first time ever, it took more than $1 billion to make the bottom of the Forbes 400 list. 25 years earlier, when the list was created, it took $90 million. Just 25 years later, it took $1 billion to hit the list. Now, the other day, I was brought down by a bank to talk about the growth of affluence. They brought me down to a yacht show in Fort Lauderdale. And the idea was I was going to talk about how the affluent market was growing, and these yacht manufacturers were going to talk about how that's good for the yachting industry. And they took me on a little tour of the yachting industry, something I didn't know much about. They told me about the different categories of luxury yacht, and they started with the super yacht. And the super yacht is about 80 feet in length. So this room is roughly 20 feet. So figure, you know, four of these rooms making the lowest category of luxury yacht, the super yacht. And after the super yacht is the mega yacht. And the mega yacht starts at 125 feet, about six of these rooms in length. Well, they've added a new category. At 200 feet plus, it's the giga yacht. A new category of luxury yacht. And so when I think of this crowd, this Forbes 400, whenever we talk about them, I feel like we're talking about the giga wealthy. Really, the top of the top of the top. Now, the giga wealthy are not the top 1%. That's a phrase you'll hear about the top 1%. They're not even the top 0.1%. They're the top 0.001%, a tiny, tiny little fraction. And according to Forbes, their combined household net worth is a staggering $1.5 trillion. Those 400 families combined, $1.5 trillion. That is a huge number. Well, after the giga wealthy, you've got the mega wealthy. That's the second tranche of yacht. It's our second tranche of wealth. And that is the top 1%. And this is a kind of wealth that does surround us. It's people with a net worth of 10 million or more. 10 million or more. That's 1% of America's households, approximately. So we're talking about 900,000 households in America. Their combined household net worth is significantly more than the giga wealthy, $12.5 trillion. They're many, many times that of the giga wealthy. Well, behind the mega wealthy comes the last tranche of wealth, the super wealthy. The super wealthy, now that's the top 10%. The top 10% of wealth in America is roughly 9 million homes, and we're talking about families that have a net worth of between $1 million and $10 million. That's mass wealth. That's sort of everyday wealth, if you will. And their combined household net worth is way, way bigger than the giga-wealthy and the mega-wealthy combined, $20.7 trillion. They truly are a force to be reckoned with. This is the group that I've been looking at for the last couple of years, and my co-author is a researcher. So when you research this market, you don't research the very wealthy. You actually research the middle class, because you will find this population, this 1 million to 10 million population, in the middle class, in the middle class neighborhoods, in middle class towns, and they look a lot like the middle class. And that's how we researched them. We surveyed 3,700 households. To get 3,700 people to respond to our survey, we had to call about 5 million homes. We call during the dinner hour, when you're most annoyed by us, and we ask you for about 45 minutes of your time. It's a survey we conducted in 2006, and it yields the results that we turned into a book called The Middle Class Millionaire. Only what I'm about to talk about this, but really what we found are trends that are taking place in the middle class, not in some rarefied existence of very, very wealthy that you might only see typically on television. This super demographic, I call them that because they're too big to be a niche and they're too small to be a full-on demographic at 9 million homes, are sometimes called the working wealthy. We call them the middle class millionaire. That's really what that super wealth category is to us, the middle class millionaire. And this group has a distinction in America being 10% of households with $20.7 trillion because it brings into focus an economic battle that's been taking place for over 100 years. So we're all familiar with John Maynard Keynes and Keynesian economics. He really makes up, in many ways, the foundation of capitalist thinking in America. And he brought us a very simple premise, that demand creates supply. If there is a demand for something, there'll be a corresponding supply for it. What most people don't know is that he's actually the winner of an economic war that was played out in the history books over many, many years. And he fought against a guy named Jean-Baptiste Say, French finance minister for Napoleon, only he came 100 years before Keynes ever came around. And Jean-Baptiste Say said the exact opposite. He said supply creates demand. And that idea, that notion, actually kind of got lost in the annals of time, and we were left with Keynesian economics. But in fact, it's helpful at this point to look back at what Jean-Baptiste Say had to say, because he actually had a lot of relevance to the time we find ourselves in. The word missing from this statement is money. Money supply creates demand. What this basically means is that if there's a supply of money, a demand will accompany it. For example, if a pack of cigarettes costs $5 and there's $50 of money supply in the world, there's the potential demand for 10 packs of cigarettes. And if the money supply went from $50 to $100, the potential demand for cigarettes would go up from 10 packs of cigarettes to 20 packs of cigarettes. The money supply in the world actually creates demand. Well, nobody, as these two were duking it out in history books, no one ever really contemplated a world where both of these folks could be true at the same time. Their theories could be true. Because what you've got is a world with enormous demand, 9 million households that have enormous demand for cars and for washing machines and microwave ovens and wardrobes and college tuitions and healthcare, backed by $20.7 trillion in household wealth. There was never really a way to contemplate such mass demand having the backup of such enormous money supply. We now find ourselves in a time where both of these gentlemen's theories are true at the same time. That's what's unique about right now. The American economy is driven by consumer spending. 70% of the American economy is consumer spending. Well, 39% of that 70% is driven by the middle class millionaire. They make up almost 40% of total consumer spending in America. That's an extraordinary amount to come from a very small population, and it gives them enormous influence in a lot of things in society, in terms of politics, in terms of services and products, and in terms of the way we build our communities. There's a word that economists use these days, it's called plutonomy. An economy that's built around the needs of wealthy people, or one that really is centered around the creation of wealth. And you'll hear this word increasingly in the news and from economists' mouths, because this is what's striking about this time. We live in a time that can arguably be called a plutonomy. That's what's different about now than ever before. Where do these folks live? Where does the middle class millionaire live? He lives all over the country, 33 states, hundreds of communities. The states here in white are the states where you'll find the highest concentration of middle-class millionaires. Now, this map doesn't come from our research. It actually comes from the National Trust for Historic Preservation. And this is a map called the Teardowns map. And this is where you'll see the highest rate of teardown activity, houses that are being torn down to make way for new ones, in America. Well, we know it as the middle-class millionaire map because we know that middle-class millionaires come to good, solid, middle-class communities, and they tear down the houses they buy, and they put up new ones. We see this happening all over the country, and we actually see it on a much bigger scale. We see it in entire new communities. In fact, one chapter in the book, we cover an entire community in Orange County called Ladera Ranch, which is built from scratch, really to service the middle-class millionaire. So it's finding its way into everyday old-line communities and new ones as well. But that's the big picture. Let me tell you about one little town. Westport, Connecticut. Anybody know it? It's a little bedroom community outside of New York. And in Westport, Connecticut, I want to tell you about a gentleman named Liam McInerney. Liam is a retired engineer for Sikorsky Helicopter. And Liam's up late one night, and he's watching a movie called The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit with Gregory Peck. Great old movie about a gentleman who works in New York City and whose family lives in Westport. And he's thinking about the success he has and all that his life has wrought. And you know, it's not the first time that Westport was used by Hollywood to demonstrate or display classic middle-class life. You might remember in the 50s when Desi and Lucy wanted to leave New York to raise little Ricky. They chose Westport as the community to raise him in. And then after that, there was a couple with a secret, a suburban couple with a secret named Darren and Tabitha. Well, before they called that show Bewitched, they actually used the name The Witch of Westport. And then more recently, Martha Stewart chose Westport to launch her catering business and media empire in a converted farmhouse called Turkey Hill. But there was never a movie about what happened on Liam McInerney's street. You see, just up the street, the Carter household is going to be raised tomorrow. And the new family coming in, the Zakaria family, is rebuilding a new house. The Carters and Liam McInerney's families grew up together, but now the families have since moved on. Liam has stayed behind, but the children have all moved on, and the Carters finally left themselves, selling their house for a lot of money. The Zakarias came in, and they love the town of Westport. They love the school system. They love the education. They love the safe streets. They love the values. They just don't love the house. The Carters left behind a modest 1950s ranch house, and it suited the Carter family very well. Mrs. Carter stayed home and raised the children, but in the Zakaria household, Mrs. Zakaria travels quite a bit for her job, so she's not there as often, so they have a housekeeper who lives there. They have more cars, more bedrooms, they have more children. That ranch house was never going to do it for the Zakaria house. See, the Zakarias are successful people, and they're used to coming into communities and re-envisioning those communities in their image. They are the classic middle-class millionaire. Liam McInerney is witness to this, and he thinks there's something wrong. He thinks they're destroying his community, and he doesn't know what's wrong with his community. Why would they destroy it? Well, they love his community, and they just want to re-envision it in their image. This is the clash that's taking place all over America as this middle-class and middle-class millionaire population duke it out to re-identify and redefine what it means to be middle-class. That's the small picture. Let's take a look at some of the numbers. We surveyed 3,714 households in 2006. We had two buckets, two groups we were looking at. One is the middle-class millionaire. A net worth of $1 million to $10 million had to be self-made, could not have received more than $50,000 from their families, including education, to make it into our survey. And then there's the second group, the middle class. A household income of $50,000 to $80,000, net worth of less than $1 million. Now, in different parts of the country, the middle class means different things. So $50,000 to $80,000 in the Bay Area may or may not sound like a middle class income. But in fact, the median income in America is about $48,000. So we started with the median, the middle income, and we went up until we hit 20% of the population. 20% of the American population falls between $50,000 and $80,000. The first question we asked them, what do you call yourself? Do you call yourself middle class, upper middle class, working class, wealthy? Surprisingly, one out of three of our seven-figure net worth households felt the word middle class best describe them. Interestingly, one out of five of households, 20% of households that had a $50,000 to $80,000 household income, felt that the words upper middle class best describe them. This brought into focus for us our very first problem. What does it mean to be middle class in America today? Is it the income you make, what you have in your bank account, the job you have, the school you went to, the house you grew up in, what you feel in your heart? What does it mean to be middle class today? It was the first question we actually had to answer in this book before we said, well, there's a difference between the two groups in the middle class now. We had to answer the question of what it means to be middle class to begin with. We found our answer not in sociology, not in economics, but in literature, where we had quotes from a number of people, but I think the one that best summed it up was George Bernard Shaw, who said, I have to live for others and not myself. That is middle class morality. And that's a key word, morality, because as we looked more closely at what it means to be middle class in America, we really started to talk about values. We found that being a good parent was universally shared by both groups as being very important. We found that providing your children with the best possible education was a high value importance. The number one value shared by the middle class and the middle class millionaire is being ethical. And just to make sure that money isn't everything, we found that good health is more important than money, is a value that's shared by both groups. Now, if you look at this list and you say to yourself, well, who wouldn't, you know, agree to these values? These are just good old-fashioned values. Well, you haven't surveyed the very, very wealthy. Because the very, very wealthy have a different answer to what's most important to them. When it comes to what's important to them by way of values, the very wealthy, and this is, in our case, we survey people with 25 million or more, they'll tell you that the most important value to them are their own personal interests and hobbies. It comes before education and everything else. And that's sort of a condemnation of very wealthy people, but it provides a little more crystal clear focus about what values mean. And that word is so important when we start to talk about the middle class. What they're saying when they say that personal interests and hobbies are the most important value to them, they're talking about things that they have to prioritize their life around, that they have to sacrifice for. So middle-class people and middle-class millionaire people will look to be in the very best community that gives their children the very best education. And to do that, they have to be able to afford a house that might stretch their budget, pay a mortgage or pay a rent that really pushes the limit. The very, very wealthy don't have to worry about that. They can live in any neighborhood they want to. They'll immediately choose the best neighborhood, and they won't really struggle with that mortgage because it's probably one of three or four or five houses they own. Or if they want to send their kid to a private school, they'll just write that tuition check. It's really not a struggle for them. They're not experiencing values in the sense of prioritization. They're not giving anything up to educate their children. But they are giving things up to do the things that are their own personal interests, which typically are things like philanthropy or collecting. Putting together a collection of artwork is an expensive proposition. And even a very wealthy family has to think, how can they find the money to really live out this collection or philanthropy? How can they push the limits of this philanthropic effort in a way that they probably have to give something else up in their lives? So that's what values comes to mean for most of us. It's easy to say, I've got a value of X. It's much harder to say, I'm willing to prioritize my life around that value and sacrifice around that value. That's really middle-class morality is about what you do that involves sacrifice, usually around sacrificing for the benefit of others, that usually means our children. That is middle-class morality. Well, how do we explain the difference between those who are thriving in this world and those who are struggling within the middle class itself? A quote from Lawrence Summers, the former Treasury Secretary for Clinton, kind of puts a fine point on it. Successful members of society are getting so much more because the world is becoming efficient at recognizing and rewarding them. The qualities that help you create wealth are leading you to create wealth faster. It's becoming more efficient. Those who are going to separate themselves off and learn the secrets of wealth creation are going to do it faster, and they're going to be able to realize that success faster and achieve greater amounts of success than ever before. The world is becoming more efficient in recognizing these types of people with these types of talents. So this is the question. What are those talents? What are those behaviors? What are those attitudes that the world is so efficiently recognizing and driving all that wealth to? Well, let's start with a few that we found in our survey that stand out. Working habits, hours worked per week. The middle-class millionaire works way more hours than the middle class, takes way fewer vacation days than the middle class. You might remember a theory called the leisure theory. And the idea was that leisure class folks, those who are owners and managers of the workplace, would work fewer hours, and the laborers would pick up all the slack. And they imagined a world in which the owners would work 20 hours a week and the laborers would work 80 hours a week. Well, the exact opposite has occurred. The hardest working people in America are the most successful people in America. It's as simple as that. There's a lot of books and notions out there about how you can get rich by not doing a lot. It's just not true. It's just not true, at least when you survey the very, very wealthy. Vacation days per year, availability at night, availability on weekends, these folks all show that they are very in touch. The second area we found is in risk-taking, taking risks and how you respond to those risks. So interestingly, we found that successful people in America, those with a seven-figure net worth, failed professionally twice as often as people who were in the middle class. How do you fail twice as often and create a net worth much, much greater? The answer is in how they respond to that failure. When we surveyed these two groups, the most common response from the middle-class millionaire was, after a failure, I tried again in a different way. The most common response from the middle class was, after a failure, I gave up and I focused on other projects. It's as though, upon failing, the middle-class millionaire says, now I know one way not to do it. And the middle class fails and says, that's a sign that I should never have tried to begin with. A completely different response to the same event that we can track back to a ton of success. Another area, we called it the influence of affluence, where we saw significant differentiation between the middle class millionaire and the middle class. Something we call being plugged in, being networked, being connected. But basically the idea is middle class millionaires tell us by virtually every measure that they know more about what's going on around them. They know more people. They talk to more people about what they like and don't like. They are asked for advice more often on things about what to buy or what to, or how to take care of children or how to take care of your elderly parents or healthcare. They know new things before other people do. The difference here between the middle class and the middle class millionaire is that the middle class millionaire views information, all the information around them, which usually is in the form of relationships, as an asset, as a hidden asset. Middle class people do not leverage this asset to create wealth for themselves. Middle class millionaire people do. Ask yourself, how many people do you know? Who would you go to if you had a good idea? Where would you find answers or opportunity? Most middle class millionaires have a long list of people they correspond with, they talk to, they share with. And you'll find this on any, it used to be the country club, but now you'll find this in any soccer field where you see all the parents lined up watching their kids play ball. And the parents are buzzing about where they went on vacation and what they're doing for careers and what car they're driving. You'll see a high energy information exchange. If you do this in the wealthier communities, you'll see that information exchange way, way, way amped up. That's what's going on in that community. So we talked about hard work. We talked about risk taking and your response to adversity. We talked about being networked. But you know what? You can be a hardworking, risk taking, networked chemistry teacher, and you're never going to create wealth. The fourth and most important aspect of wealth creation is enlightened self-interest, that you work in your own enlightened self-interest. This is where the rubber meets the road in terms of wealth creation. This is the one that's going to explain a lot about why many of us fail to create wealth and why a few of us actually manage to do it. First of all, we share common values, the middle class and the middle class millionaire. We share a commitment to our careers, although the middle-class millionaire is much more committed to those careers. We share a commitment to this notion of something called financial independence, although the middle-class millionaire is universally committed to financial independence as a goal. The middle class, two-thirds of the middle class, shares this goal. These are pretty straightforward ideas, and most of us can relate to them as being virtuous, even if they're not our virtues. And they reveal themselves in terms of something we've already talked about, working very hard or choosing projects that have substantial risk but also substantial reward. And these are American ideas. Work hard, take chances, succeed. These all sound good. Let's look at some other notions of wealth creation that are real, that measure out in our research, that may not sound as good. Middle-class millionaires are much more willing to leverage the legal system to become successful. Okay? Middle-class millionaires are much more willing to take advantage of weaknesses in other people to become successful. Middle-class millionaires believe that it's okay to be Machiavellian to succeed. We now have a question in front of all of us. What are you willing to do to create wealth? Are you willing to leverage the legal system? Are you willing to take advantage of weakness in others? You may not like these qualities, but Dr. Lawrence Summers shared with us his perspective. The market is becoming efficient. It's recognizing people who have good wealth creation capabilities, and it's sending success their way. Now, there are two other ways to create wealth that I haven't talked about. One is to be fantastically talented at something, like being a great baseball player, and the other is to be incredibly lucky. But if you don't have those two things going for you, you're going to have to work with the rest of us and do these things that it takes to become successful. Hard work, take chances. You'll have to look for opportunities, even in places that you have to question, is this what I want to do? Is this the kind of person I am? That is the efficient marketplace of wealth creation we find ourselves in this country today. And it explains why there is a thriving middle class with seven-figure net worth and a struggling middle class. Here's what we heard from the middle class, where they told us what they think it takes to be successful. The middle class told us thinking like a millionaire will help them become successful. The middle class millionaire didn't quite agree with that. The middle class told us that having a success attitude, positive thinking, positive outlook, will help them create wealth. Middle class millionaire wants nothing to do with that. Cut back on little luxuries. If you bypass your latte for $3.50, you can become rich. It's ridiculous, says the middle-class millionaire. Ridiculous. Failure's okay, as long as you tried your best. The middle class believes that. The middle-class millionaire doesn't think that's true at all. I want to work with good people. That's what the middle class believes. Middle-class millionaire doesn't care who they work with. They're trying to be successful. If working with a bad person makes them successful, that's what they'll do. This is the difference between those who have accumulated wealth and those who dream about wealth. It also doesn't take anything having to do with education or marital status or gender. In all of our research, we equalize out for all these things, and there's an equal distribution both of the wealth and of the qualities it takes, even those tough qualities, to be found amongst men, women. One of the common responses I hear is, I can't take those kinds of chances, or I can't be entrepreneurial because I've got a family. Well, people with families are as represented among the wealthy as people without. Not only is education not relevant, it seems to be an inverse indicator. The better educated you are, the less likely you are to create real wealth. PhDs are the kiss of death when it comes to wealth creation. The only thing that might work is an MBA, but for the most part, higher education has no correlation to wealth creation. It's the choices that people make that will tell us whether or not they create wealth. A primary care physician by the name of Howard Marin, in the spring of 1996, sent out a letter to 2,000 of his patients. And in that letter, he said, I'm retiring from the practice of medicine, and I invite you to find another physician, and he made some recommendations. But for 100 of his patients, those that he knew or suspected were very wealthy, he sent a different letter. And that letter said, I'm inviting you to be one of 100 patients in my new healthcare practice called MD Squared, exponentially better healthcare than you've ever received. And for the mere $12,000 a year, you could be a patient in this new club. And as a member of the club, he offered some pretty wonderful benefits. He offered, for example, a full physical. Now, according to the American Medical Association, a physical should take about 90 minutes. Raise your hand if you've ever had a 90-minute physical from your doctor. Okay, he promised full physicals. He promised house calls. He would coordinate your prescriptions. He would coordinate your specialists. He would go with you to the specialists if it made sense. He only sees two or three patients a day. He's got plenty of time to work with his patients. Well, flash forward 10 years. That's 1996. Flash forward to 2006. There are now thousands of doctors practicing what Dr. Howard Marin started. It became something known as concierge healthcare. And there are hundreds of thousands of patients who fall under this category of concierge healthcare. And they're not paying $12,000 a year anymore. They're paying, on average, $1,500 a year. But here's really what matters the most. These patients are healthier. They're admitted to hospitals less than people of the same age. They experience fewer incidents of the outbreaks of disease of people the same age. They're spending more time on their health, and they're more committed to their health than people their same age, and we see it through the money they spend and the time they spend. Now, there's an experiment underway in Seattle, backed by venture capital, to create concierge healthcare practices that are around $50 a month. That's about the price of your cell phone bill for better healthcare. And now political candidates are hanging around, and from my friends in this industry, I hear that, you know, that Clinton and Obama and McCain have been sniffing around. What's going on? Is this a solution to healthcare? Have you stumbled on something to fix what we have? But you know what? It's nothing more than just old-fashioned medicine. What happened about 50 years ago? You saw a doctor, you paid him for services rendered, and that was it. The healthcare experience is better, though. This started because very, very wealthy people were looking for a better solution to healthcare, and they wanted to use their money to get it. Now, some people derisively call this wealth care, that it's a really rarefied, elitist system that's not available to everyone else. It shouldn't happen. But now we see that this is really finding its way down to everyone. So the message I want to send tonight is this notion that creating wealth with all the qualities, all the hard work, all the risk-taking, all those qualities that are not so positive may or may not be what you want to do, but you are receiving the benefits of this type of energy and activity that's taking place at the very, very high end, because things like healthcare are changing as a result of it. The communities we live in, the houses we live in, those teardowns, which many of us look askance at, are creating housing technologies, smart technologies, green technologies that are finding their way into regular homes. There's a lot of innovation that takes place. This is what led Dr. Friedman to say this statement. When it comes to innovation, the rich work for the poor. So we live in a country that's a plutonomy. We live in a country with a massive 9 million household population of millionaires. Many of us both struggle with the idea that we both, you know, think that that's unfair at some level, and at the same time, we want to be part of it. We're part of this country where we hold egalitarianism and meritocracy together, but we hate when they don't work perfectly together. Some people actually are so good at what they do that they actually go beyond what we ever expected. But that situation, that condition of our country, 9 million households with that much wealth, having that many demands and with that much money ready to back it up, are creating benefits for the rest of us. I think one of the questions for many of us is going to be, well, is wealth creation all that it's cracked up to be? Are we willing to do the things it takes to become wealthy? And that's the nature of what's happening in America today, this notion that efficient ways are revealing themselves to become wealthy, and they're not the kinds of things that you might talk about in polite company. That's the condition we find ourselves in today. You would never have named Dr. Marin when I was asking you to name the faces of wealth. We talk about Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, but no one would ever say Dr. Howard Marin. But in fact, Dr. Howard Marin became very, very rich by trying a new method of healthcare, the one that led to this phrase, concierge healthcare. And he's a face of wealth. You know, another gentleman that no one would ever mention when you think of the true icons of wealth in this country's history is this man. Everything that Ben Franklin is known for, his contribution to science and letters and philosophy and art, his early contribution to diplomacy in the earliest days of this country, all of those things happened after he turned 42. But he spent the first 25 years of his life, of his adult life, 16 to 42, intensely focused on getting rich. And when he died, he was one of the wealthiest people in America and one of the very few to do it through business. Some people call him the first American because he exhibits these qualities, or the first entrepreneur. In many ways, I think he exemplifies the characteristics we see in middle-class millionaires today and admire in some ways. So all of us have a vision of success, a vision of what we want to accomplish. And the question is, now that we have the research to show us what it's going to take to succeed, to create that marketplace where the wealth comes to us, and it's not thinking like a millionaire, and it's not, you know, not spending $3 on a latte, it's hard work, perseverance, risk-taking, it's winning when you might be in a situation where you could lose. It's tough, tough stuff, stuff that we may not all be comfortable doing. So you ask yourself, you have a vision of success, and the question now is, what are you willing to do to make yourself realize that success? Really, the question is, how available are you to prepared to make yourself to that vision? Are you willing to tap into other resources of other people that you know to create success, to network? Are you willing to work extra hours, nights and weekends? Are you willing to take chances, even though in the past you might have avoided chances? Are you willing to do what it takes to win? These are the questions. We know when we look at the icons of wealth, the choices that they've made. They made the kinds of choices and they took the kinds of paths that led to substantial success. Whatever choice you make, I want to wish you the very best of success and invite you to give me any questions about this research that you have at this point. Thanks so much.
Lewis, thanks so much for some really terrific insights there. Conjures up all sorts of emotions for many of us, I'm sure, and you know, everything from envy or possibly jealousy and all those other things. But I'm just curious about this, you know, maybe the cynic in all of us that said, oh, it's just luck, you know, these folks and this and that. And you certainly, a lot of your research put a lot of that to naught. But what about the issue of timing? In other words, did your research reveal anything with regard to, you know, the age continuum and that kind of thing? Any comments along those lines?
Sure. Well, one thing is whatever your number that you think it would take for you to feel wealthy, it gets smaller as you get older. And the difference between what you have and what it'll take, it's smaller. But if you start at age 30, 40 or so, you ask someone how much it's going to take, it's almost always 10 times more than they have. So the lower end of our group, the middle class, had roughly an average net worth of $250,000. And when we asked them what would it take to feel wealthy, the answer was $2.8 million, a little bit more than 10 times what they had. When we asked the middle class millionaire, who roughly has a $2.5 million net worth, the answer was $28 million, roughly 10 times more than they had. And I can assure you that if they had $28 million, the answer would be $280 million. So the very nature of wealth is that we always want more than we have, and it's a kind of a plateau. You reach it, and you look up to the next one. But that number narrows as you get older. It's hard for a person in their 60s and 70s to imagine, you know, 10xing their wealth at that age. But, you know, one of the things that's interesting about the middle-class millionaire is that they're not the baby boomers. There's plenty of wealthy seven-figure households headed by people in their 30s. And that's never before happened in this country. Not only that level of wealth, but even if you adjust it for other times and other dollar values, it's never happened. So we have a lot of young people in their 30s who have said, sure, I have $2 million and I'm in my 30s. I could see myself having $25 million. That seems reasonable, definitely.
One other quick question before I turn it to the audience. On your table of qualities and attitudes and so forth, there was that thing about being willing to take advantage of the weakness of others. And I don't want to overly parse that phraseology there, but is there perhaps a difference between taking advantage of others and taking advantage of the weakness of others?
Yeah, I think that's nicely put. That's nicely put. We surveyed middle-class millionaires in the first quarter of 2008. Okay, this is a bad economic environment, and we asked this population who tells us that they can persevere in the face of adversity. So we said, well, gee, there's adverse conditions for all of us right now. I wonder what they'll say they're doing right now. And interestingly, one of their answers was, we're renegotiating with everybody in our lives. We're renegotiating with our vendors, with our customers, with our employees, because they're counting on the fact that most people are going to look at this time, this economic time, and say, better keep my head down, keep my hands in my pockets, wait till it passes, and then I'll stick my head up again. The middle-class millionaire is saying the opposite, saying, if people are feeling paralyzed and scared, this is the time to strike. There's a ton of mergers and acquisitions activity taking place in small businesses in America today because middle-class millionaires who run these businesses are saying, now is my moment. Yeah.
Good presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kind of tacking onto the timing issue, do you have some information about when those groups that you described, when they've grown to those percentages that they are, how recently has that phenomenon been in place?
Well, so the important thing here is that the middle class millionaire has failed 3.1 times on average compared to the middle class of 1.6. So they are destroying their fortunes and then remaking them multiple times in their lifetime. So it's not like they reach it and they're done. So they may have it now, and they may lose it tomorrow, and they may get it back in the future. One of the funny things is when you set out to create wealth, and you might not even use that word wealth. It's the word I use, but let's just say you set out to create financial security for yourself. Okay, you don't have visions of grandeur, and you don't have visions of riding on yachts and limousines. You just want to create financial security for yourself. Well, most people don't say, when I hit a million, I'm going to stop, you know? Like, they just do what they do, and they learn how to create wealth, and they keep doing it. And so, and then along the way, many of those people lose portions of that fortune and then make it again. We surveyed middle-class millionaires again just recently, and we asked them about how their real estate was doing. Really, the question was, are any middle-class millionaires in danger of losing their homes? And the answer was no. None of them are in that kind of danger. But a huge number, 20% of them, said that they were likely to walk away from investment real estate. That's a big, big, big number. But for them, it means, okay, they're going to lose $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, $400,000. It's not going to stop them from moving forward. But most of us would not want to lose that kind of money. But for them, it's not a game changer. You know, they're going to keep going. Bad years, good years. Bad years, good years. One of the reasons why we can't use income to measure the middle-class millionaire. We use household net worth for the middle-class millionaire and income for the middle class. It's because the middle-class millionaire plays too many games with their income. Some years they hold back income so that, you know, benefits them tax-wise, and some years they push it forward, and it's just too hard to figure out what their real income is. So middle-class millionaires have a lot more choices and ways to spend money. They have equity that regular people don't have. They can move money around in their own little internal economic biosystem that others don't have. They're much more able to withstand tough economic times because of that than regular middle-class people have. So money is very fluid to them. Sir?
Sure. The question, in differentiating the middle class and the middle-class millionaire, do you find any differences in the type assets? In other words, I'm sure in the middle class, the home was probably the number one asset, and the pension plan or 401k or 201k was probably the biggest asset. Was anything different in the middle class?
Yeah. The middle class millionaire was two-thirds of the time likely to be a business owner. So in addition to those types of assets you've mentioned, they own the assets of their business. And other non-traditional assets like it could be real estate, it could be artwork, things like that. But the biggest one would be their value of their business. Commercial investment real estate. That gentleman and I were talking earlier, and I know he's in the financial services field. So there's a whole way of looking at middle-class millionaires and what the difference is. But it comes down to the fact that, and I won't make any characterizations about the people in this room, but most of us have an income, and we have savings and things like investment plans. Well, wealthy people have a much more diverse set of things going on in their financial life. It creates complexity, but it also creates opportunity.
My name is Al Hausner, and my question is, do your surveys inquire about people's attitude towards taxation? Given the popularity now of increased taxes on the so-called wealthy, do your respondents react to that?
Yeah. Middle-class people hate income taxes. Middle-class millionaires hate capital gains taxes. Very, very wealthy people hate estate taxes. So the higher up in wealth you go, the more you – first of all, very, very wealthy people have a way of altering their income so that it's more like capital gains income. It's tricky and not very fair, but they do it all the time. So income tax is important to most of us, and then it becomes capital gains. And then if you're familiar with estate taxes, which are hovering at $2.5 million, before you have to start paying them. There's a lot of people, myself included, who spend a lot of their time helping wealthy people change the face of their wealth so that they're not as exposed to estate taxes. It's a good business because, you know, most of the time, a client has a $20 million tax bill. Well, if I can do something that costs less than $20 million, they're happy to do it. So it's a good business to be in. But of course, in 2011, the estate tax exemption goes away. We'll see if I'm in business. And it comes back in 2012. We'll see. But there's a question back here.
Once someone has acquired this amount of wealth, the upper middle class you're talking about, what is their general feeling about investing it in risky ways, preservation of wealth? Are they risk takers there like they are in their businesses? What's the general feeling on that?
Generally, you know, there's something larger at work, which is people who learn how to create wealth have a very different comfort level with the whole idea of wealth. They're much more sophisticated investors. That term, sophisticated investor, or sometimes the financial services world uses this phrase, accredited investor, basically means you have enough comfort and familiarity with money to be able to look at things like hedge funds and private equity, and they do. That's what they're interested in. They're interested in what are called alternative investments, kind of weird things, limited partnerships, hedge funds, private equity, or real estate investment trusts. Most of us, A, are not accredited. We're not even permitted into these things. B, we don't understand them. And C, we're not comfortable with them. So there is an entirely different way of investing for wealthy people that most of us never have access to and don't understand. For those of you who believe in karma, you know, the good thing is that all those hedge fund investors are getting hosed right now. So as it works, it's all the way around.
second question. You didn't talk about family values. So I saw that education for children were very high up on the value chain. But I also see working 70 hours, taking 12 days of vacation, et cetera. And I'm just wondering, in general, in your surveys, did you discuss time with family and family? And then as people get older, were there any regrets in attaining this upper middle class status?
Well, the second part, no. But, you know, at the risk of putting you on the spot, successful people who work real hard don't get to spend that much time with their families. And yet they tell us that family values are terribly important to them. It is a dichotomy, but it's one that they have a strong justification for, which is the things I'm doing are creating opportunity for my children, and that to them translates into family values. They will say there's an entire industry around helping get things done for you so that you don't have to spend time doing them yourself. For example, fractional jets are becoming extremely popular with wealthy people because if you're going to take your family on vacation, you don't want to have to go through the commercial airport system, take 3 hours to go through the security lines, go on a flight on their schedule. So what they're doing is they're spending time on fractional jets, fractional homes, fractional yachts, where they're converting ownership into a service. I have a whole chapter on the book, actually, this idea that instead of owning things, why don't you rent them? And when you rent them, they should be ready and waiting for you so you don't have to worry about them. I think some people would say, gee, you're working 70 hours a week, you don't spend time with your family. Others would say, middle-class people spend so much time in their family homes cleaning the gutters and mowing the lawn, they're not spending time with their kids either. So they have two different answers to that. There is an increase in personal interests and hobbies amongst the middle class that the middle-class millionaire doesn't share. So I told you very, very wealthy people will tell you that their interests and hobbies are very important to them. Interestingly, in a barbell effect, middle-class people will say the same thing. Middle-class millionaires have only two things that are important to them, business and family, and they don't have any personal interests outside of that. And they'll tell you that that's family values. I'm not saying it is or it isn't, but that's their sort of take on it. Sir?
Yes. Is $1 million a lot of money these days, considering inflation?
So there's a phrase that 10 million is the new million. You know, so this idea that it takes $10 million to feel like you used to say, oh, if I was a millionaire, I'd feel great. Now it takes 10 million.
Well, most people in the Bay Area, if they own a home, I mean, they have $1 million.
Well, here's a question. I was chatting with some gentlemen earlier. If I were to ask the members of this room who don't have $1 million, if I said, if you had $1 million, would your life be much easier? The answer would almost universally be yes. If I asked those people in the room who have a net worth of $1 million whether their life is easier because they have it, the answer would universally be no. So there's a distinct, you know, difference in this perception of what money gets you. It turns out money, you know, enough money, a lot of money, doesn't get you most of the things people fantasize it gets you. Mostly what it gets you is like a cushion or an insurance against bad times. Wealthy people will tell you having money when things are tough, that could be economically tough, it could be a family emergency or a medical problem, they'll tell you having money makes those times easier. But they won't tell you money made me happier. They won't tell you money made my marriage better. They won't tell you money made my children smarter. They won't say any of those things because it's not true. So this notion of what does it mean to be a millionaire or a 10 millionaire, it's fiction. It's fiction, except for the fact that there are some tough times that will help you through.
Lewis, we'll take a couple more questions. I just want to remind our audience that we're listening to Lewis Schiff talk to us about the changing face of American wealth. Maybe if you would just share a little bit more about your own story. You spoke earlier about getting plugged in and the energy and the information and so forth and all that. But you told us about your long drive out here from New York, and you worked in an auto repair shop. And then what happened? Share some pieces along the line there.
It's a haze. I did go back to New York. I mean, you know, my story is that my shoulda, coulda, woulda is what if I had stayed in Silicon Valley? You know, as an 18 or 19-year-old, halfway decently smart kid, what if I had stayed in Silicon Valley? And that's the question of my life. I went back to New York. I did what people do in New York, which is I went to work in the media business, magazines, and then it became websites and things like that. And I happened to be there when the Silicon Alley boom was happening, which was some companies that went public. I got a chance to be part of that. I found my way into money and as a topic and as a kind of a vocation. The question in my life is, what if I had stayed here? I really don't know the answer to that. I think about it quite a bit. Sir?
Question. You have a question, Mr. Schiff. In the end, aren't you telling young people it does not matter what you do to make it, but only that you make it?
I'm not telling that to young people. I'm saying the facts show, the numbers show, that to make it requires a prioritization towards making it, and not how you make it. There's a question in our survey. One question is, do what you love, and the money will follow. Well, middle-class people think that's true. Then the other question is, choose a career because it's potentially financially rewarding. Middle-class millionaires think that's true. Middle-class people, I'm going to say delude themselves because it just doesn't bear out. Middle-class people will say, if I love doing this, somehow I'll create wealth doing it. And middle-class millionaires say, if I find a way to become wealthy, I don't care what it is, I'll find a way to love it. And it's a completely different take on the same question. So, in a sense, and now obviously there's moral and ethical and legal issues here, but the people we surveyed will use words like working in the gray areas, that they have to work in the gray areas. But none of them say, I commit crimes to become wealthy. I do, by the way, someone I work with has a Russian billionaire, a new Russian billionaire, an oligarch, as a client, who said, do you think you could become a billionaire without being a crook? It's not possible. So, you know, that's his take, and he's a Russian oligarch. But, you know, I mean, I think at the billionaire level, I would say most of those people are extremely comfortable in the gray areas, would be the way I'd put it. Yes, sir.
Mr. Schiff, talk a little more about your ideas of the role of education in all of this. You commented that it didn't have much correlation. And, of course, the mantra for years and years since the Second World War, really, is go to college and you'll make more money. I'm not so sure it can be dismissed quite the way you dismiss it, but I'd be interested in your thoughts.
Right. Well, I do. I mean, I really, I'm exaggerating to make a point, but I do kind of dismiss it in the sense that bachelor degrees are equally represented amongst these two groups in roughly equal percentages, as are master's degrees. As I said, higher degrees than that start to show up much more often in the middle class than the middle class millionaires. It's an interesting topic. It's probably one of the most interesting topics because, you know, the premise of this book is not partly to see what it takes to be wealthy, and partly it's to see what kind of world wealthy people would create, or at least this combination of middle class millionaires and middle class people would create. Middle-class millionaires will tell you, and it's a cliche, except I've heard it so many times now, it definitely falls into the category of cliches that are true, seem to be true. I went to the school of hard knocks. They will tell you that the things they learned on the job or in professional experiences have meant so much more to them in terms of their professional development, leaving aside education as an erudition and sort of a mind-expanding program. They will tell you that from a vocational point of view, the things they learn on the job matter much more. What becomes interesting is watching them with their own children, because they are very, very aggressive in getting their children into the best schools. They are creating an industry that would turn your head around in terms of coaching for kids. We profile a $30,000 coaching program for your children that can help them get into a better school. And it's obviously something that only wealthy people could afford, although it is, again, which is consistent with the theme of the book, finding its way downstream. Here's what's interesting. Again, it comes to the attitudes, perspectives. Middle-class millionaires will tell you they want their children to get into the best schools because they want their children to get ahead. Middle-class people will tell you they want their children to get into the best schools so that they don't get left behind. There's a clear split in terms of why they are pursuing education for their children. Getting ahead in prestigious schools actually means something very specific amongst this population, which is networking. They want their kids in prestigious schools because they want their kids to go to a school with the right kids. Most middle-class millionaires didn't have a network. They built it themselves. They want to accelerate their children's development by putting them in prestigious schools. If you want to ask me what the importance of prestigious educations is to the middle-class millionaire, I'd say they put a high priority on it. For those few that did get into what would be considered the 50 prestigious schools in the country, they'll tell you it was great for them. But they'll tell you it was great because of the people they met, not because of the education they got. And people in academia, you know, that doesn't always sound comfortable and right, but that's what they tell us.
Lewis, one last question, really, and then I'm sure some other people may come up to you afterward and chat for a second if you have it, but what would be the one thought you'd want to leave with us here? I mean, you've provided some really awesome insights, I think, in terms of all of these qualities, attitudes, and everything else. But what would be one significant finding of your research and theme in the book or whatever that you'd like to leave with us?
I think, Tom, that I think there's an industry around telling people that they can become wealthy. And I think that that's not true. And I think we set out to debunk that to some extent. Just like with anything else, it's the old 80-20 rule. 20% of the people will do it, 80% of the people won't. I think there is this huge industry that says, you know, here's all the products you can buy and the CD-ROMs you can buy and the books you can buy to teach you how to create wealth. And you can do it if you're lazy. You can do it if you're stupid. You can do it if you're unlucky. I'll tell you how. And I think it's pretty clear that none of those ideas are true. And it leads me to what I think is, I hope, provocative. And maybe for some of us, we'll open our minds in new ways, which is not everyone should be pursuing the creation of wealth, that we should try and find ways to live in this earth without making wealth creation our goal, and doing what we love to do, and working within systems that value that and protect that. And then others will say, I'm willing to do what it takes to be wealthy and to love and respect those two different paths, but to not sort of live your life as if you're keeping up with the Joneses when the Joneses are willing to do what it takes and you're not, because you're digging a hole for yourself. And when you dig that hole for yourself, you're creating a form of wage slavery for yourself that's going to last the rest of your life, and you're going to be unhappy about it. I think money is not happiness, and not everyone's going to get it, and finding a way to live your life without it, where you have a modest financial life as opposed to a glamorous one, is an idea that most people should be embracing. Most people should embrace that notion. Yeah.
Lewis, thanks for sharing some really interesting and challenging insights. Let's put our hands together for you.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
I do want to mention that Stacy's bookstore does have Lewis's book out outside the other room for purchase. And I also want to indicate that Lewis has with him some one-page little feedback forms. If you desire to pick one of those up, please see him afterward here. And Interestingly, if you fill out that form, then he's also got an email list full of tips and this kind of thing that you can get on by filling out the form and your reaction to this session. And now this session of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you so much for coming.